It was Virginia Woolf who wrote famously and contentiously that a woman must have money and a room of her own if she is to write fiction. If a woman is to write music, if she is to be a composer, even more is needed. As the musicologist Suzanne Cusick has said, music is fundamentally about movement, sociability, and change. Women do not so much need rooms of our own within which we can retreat from the world, as we need ways of being in the world that allow us to engage with the often immobilizing and silencing effects of gender norms. I would argue that a female composer, to be successful, needs to be working in a community that not only values her art, but enables it to be heard beyond the traditional spaces for women's music. Today, I'm going to be talking about some of those communities. I'll also be exploring the boundaries of those traditionally female spaces for making music, which might be more porous or more elastic. Their boundaries might be more porous and elastic than perhaps we've thought. But the three most important words I've said so far are to be heard. It was possible, in the right place, at the right time, to be heard. But even for those happy few, being heard in their lifetime was not a guarantee of being heard now. So let's start in Florence. It is carnival time. It's February. And the Medici court are celebrating a great military victory against the Ottoman Turk, achieved by their honoured guest, Crown Prince Vladislav Sigismund Vasa of Poland. No matter that the Battle of Chotyn 4 years earlier had in reality been a shambolic, bloody stalemate in which Vladislav had played little active part, a lavish, spectacular entertainment, sadly this isn't the exact entertainment, but it gives you an idea of the scale we're looking at, is needed. One that not only demonstrates the triumph of goodness over evil, but the immense wealth and power of the Medici family, the rulers of the Grand Duchy of Tuscany. The story chosen tells of a wicked sorceress, Alcina, who seduces a knight, Ruggiero, entrapping him on her island in order to take her pleasure. Worse still, he and a host of other previous victims seem to enjoy the experience. Part opera, part ballet, no expense is spared in the production, which will end with an extraordinary balletto a cavallo, dancing horses, which you can see in this image here, which the audience watches from the balconies and terraces of the Villa Poggio Imperiale, a ruinously expensive symbol of Medici power, linked to the city of Florence below by a tree-lined avenue. The date is the 3rd of February, 1625. And the entertainment is La Liberazione di Ruggiero dall'Isola d'Alcina, the liberation of Roger from the island of Alcina. And the composer is 36-year-old Francesca Caccini, working at the height of her career. Many factors contributed towards this remarkable moment. She was lucky, Caccini was lucky to be the daughter of two remarkable musicians. She was fortunate to have been born in Florence, the creative centre of the Medici world. But above all, she was in the right place and the right time because there were the right rulers. The woman on the right there is the wife of Cosimo Medici on the left, who was sickly most of his life and died leaving a young son, thus creating a space for first Cosimo's mother, Christine de Lorraine, and then his wife, Maria Maddalena of Austria, who was rather typically called an Amazon. Funny how powerful women are always Amazonian. So the Medici world in which Caccini thrived was politically female. These were powerful women in need of a soundtrack to justify their monstrous regiment. And they found in Caccini a woman to provide that soundtrack. She was, in the records, La Musica. She was the music. She provided the music for their reign. Her venues ranged throughout the Tuscan state. Here we have the Palazzo Pitti Theatre, which gives you an idea where that entertainment we've just talked about would have taken place. Caccini was prolific and expert, both as performer and as well as composer, and she had remarkable energy. Her letters speak of a determined, capable, formidable woman. As she said, "If the Medici ball bounces to my hand, I won't let it get away." Very little of her music survives. Here you have the cover of the one collection of arias and duets that we have. You'll notice, of course, that the most important name here is that of the Medici, Cardinal de' Medici. And Caccini, really, you have to look, here we are, up here. Nei Signorini, that's another story. But at least we do have this. It's a superb collection and gives us a glimpse of how Caccini seized her moment, how she caught the Medici ball. So here is a very short extract from one of the works from Il Primo Libro. Those of you who like your early 17th century music, those of you who like your Monteverdi and your laments, this is Caccini's, the beginning of Caccini's contribution to the genre. Absolutely beautiful. When the two women rulers were replaced by the grown-up son, Caccini's moment passed, at least politically. She spent some time in Lucca and then returned to Florence to a convent. And I just want to talk a little bit about her time at the convent of La Crocetta. Once again, and there it is on the left-hand side of the picture there, she was immersed in a woman's world. Widow Francesca Caccini was permitted to enter the Monastero of La Crocetta with her girl. That's her daughter. Her new centre of female activity would be the Dominican Monastery of Santa Croce, a convent, not a court. La Crocetta was, however, no ordinary convent. Back in 1619, one of Christine de Lorraine's daughters, Maria Maddalena, had expressed a wish to enter La Crocetta Accordingly, the Medici architects spent 2 years creating a suitable palazzo with an enclosed garden that could adjoin the convent for the princess and her resident staff of 4 unmarried adult women and 2 17-year-old donne. There were servants, there was very much an interplay between this convent and the secular court. The usual restrictions on nuns' movements, of course, didn't apply to these Medici women or indeed to their servants, much to the dismay of the church authorities. The convent, as it was in Caccini's time, no longer exists, but a map from the building shows a substantial building, no wonder with all that new build, dominated by the chapel with a large garden. 2 covered walkways, and you can see one of them there, do still straddle what is now the Via Laura, providing a link between the former palace of the Medici princesses and the convent. Of the convent's interior, only a small part of the chapel survives, now part of the Hotel Morandi alla Crocetta. When I visited in 2014, the charming hotel receptionist scurried off to check whether the chapel was being used. And I was imagining a kind of spiritual sanctuary, candles, perhaps the sound of music in the background, incense, what have you. But the receptionist took me along various corridors and ushered me into this room on the right, a hotel bedroom, which is also one end of the chapel. It was a strange moment, past and present colliding, spiritual and secular colliding even more. Then again, in a sense, that's what La Crocetta was all about, at least when Caccini was working there, a perfect example of what has been called the permeability between convent and outside world. Let's move north to Venice, northeast, and to the composer who had become known as Barbara Strozzi, and who saw that magnificent church, Santa Maria della Salute, being built during her childhood. Here is an iconic, probably for all the wrong reasons, picture of Strozzi. But what does it tell us about the composer and Venice? Well, I think it's obvious. It reveals that the sexual and musical economies of that city are absolutely entwined. We're not just talking about courtesans, often being the most proficient, talented, celebrated musicians or female musicians of the time. We're also talking about the Venetian academies, where intellectuals, musicians, philosophers came together, librettists, to discuss the latest ideas, the latest cultural phenomena. Venice, of course, is the city of opera, where opera, public opera at least, is beginning. But Venice, for all its riches, was a double-edged sword for, at least, for a female composer. Yes, it was the city of light, the city of wonder, the city of exceptional talents. "Let him who cannot amaze work in the stables," wrote Giambattista Marino, capturing the city's hunger for the virtuoso. Yes, Venice was the home of the libertines, intellectuals and artists of the academies. Yes, palaces became places where the rich and not so rich could mix, where libertines and poets debated with skeptical philosophers, and librettists tried out their texts for the new musical phenomenon, public opera. You've got 16 theatres, only 140,000 inhabitants. Venice was, in the words of one historian, a kind of ongoing performance, the setting for many ritual events engaging large numbers of actors as well as spectators, ranging from the procession of the True Cross to the anarchy of carnival. No wonder opera found its true home there, and no wonder that singers became the most important force in the music industry, whether on stage, in private, or even in church. According to music historians, individual singers were worshipped like rock stars today and might be paid twice as much as the composers of their music. Anna Renzi, admired and promoted by Giulio Strozzi, the man who raised Barbara here, earned 750 ducats for just one opera run, had a 17-year career of opera performance working in Rome and Venice, whilst also achieving a secure position at the court in Innsbruck. Now, this was not Strozzi's path. What was her strategy? To sum it up in one word, it was print. As Venetian a phenomenon as courtesans, academies, and opera. Strozzi published 8 volumes of music, 7 of which survive, more than any other composer in the 17th century. Here's a couple of them. You can see the quest for patronage going on there, whether an archduchess on the left or a future doge on the right. But it was a quest that never quite worked. She never became like Caccini, La Musica. But still, she published. Her final works date from 1657, 1659, and 1664. And with each of these last late works, she became ever more confident and sophisticated as a composer, embracing works of larger scale, even more drama. She prepared these publications assiduously, performance markers. She was somebody who really cared about this music going out into the world and being performed. She wanted, I believe, as precise and as authentic a legacy of her art as she could provide. Is it fanciful to see her publication programme as a quest for professional recognition, part of her self-definition as a composer first, singer second? Could she have been seeking a fourth way beyond wife? Impossible, for reasons I won't go into now. Nun, implausible, for the same reasons. And courtesan, concubine, only too plausible. As a professional published composer, she could bypass the prince, not to mention the prince's bedroom, and go straight to her public. Here is a short extract from Opus 7. Listen to the remarkable opening wail, a reminder that Venice looks east as well as west. Plenty more like that. Someone who did gain a prince's favour was Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, and it was the favour of the Sun King himself, Louis XIV. And Versailles, which you see there on one of the coldest February days I've ever experienced, there is nowhere to hide, was indeed an important community for Jacquet de la Guerre. Louis XIV and one of his most significant mistresses, Madame de Montespan, provided Jacquet de la Guerre with education, a stage, a world in which to cut her teeth as a composer. But in actual fact, the patronage of Louis XIV, important though it was, and Jacquet de la Guerre would dedicate all of her music except one published work to him, so far, so Medici. But it only goes so far, and I would argue that it's back in Paris that you find the two most important musical communities for Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre. One, for some years, was centred on La Sainte-Chapelle, which you can see on the right of that image there. Elizabeth Jacquet married Marin Laguerre. It was a musical alliance. He was the organist, eventually, of La Sainte-Chapelle. And we've got a marvellous description, in fact, a rare description, of their lodgings. On the left-hand side, you can see, in this building here. Not a long commute. Elizabeth and Marin had a large reception room, 3 bedrooms, a small office, a kitchen, and an attic in the Palais de la Cité. The salle was the heart of the apartment for the two musicians, perhaps more so for Elizabeth than for Marin, whose main responsibilities lay in the church opposite. We know that the room was richly furnished. Along with her harpsichord, there were at least six armchairs, four couches and four chairs. It is easy to imagine gatherings for concerts, the walls draped with tapestries celebrating the power of the king. The room also contained something of a library, including six folio volumes containing the works of Lully, the man to beat, of course, at that time, and numerous other works of theology, history, and equally learned subjects. Now, the nature of Jacquet de la Guerre's reception room with its instruments and seating makes it tempting to imagine her presiding over a salon. But I think it's an improbable or inappropriate vision. It's one thing to describe the literary and musical gatherings initiated and bankrolled by courtiers, such as the Duchess of Guise in their lavish hotels, as salons. It is completely another, I would argue, to describe a concert held by a petit bourgeois artisan class, Jacquet de la Guerre, as a salon. Class matters, even in the etymology of the word salon itself. It means, literally, a large reception room from the Italian sala. But during Jacquet de la Guerre's working life, the word was first used in Versailles to connote the musical performances that took place in certain, and only certain, architectural spaces, specifically courtly, noble architectural spaces. In these noble salons, music often remained a secondary element. We'll come across this again later. Musicians were hired and works were commissioned to provide background entertainment, in most cases, or interludes between conversations, as had been the case with Strozzi in the academies in Venice, and would be the case in so many in many so-called salons well into the 18th century. Perhaps not a salon, therefore, in the Palais de la Cité. Perhaps something even better. An apartment where Jacquet de la Guerre performs, hears others perform, where up to a point the classes could mingle, and in which she could maintain her practice and identity as a performer, teacher, and composer. A place to make music and connections. A place to be heard. And into these rooms we can tentatively put this beautiful image of Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre. One of the rare instances of a woman composer being portrayed as a composer. She rests her elbow on a harpsichord, probably one made by her father, which brings me to perhaps an environment that's even more important than the Sainte-Chapelle. This is the Île Saint-Louis. Jacquet de la Guerre was born there, and she returned there again and again to ply her trade. Now, if you know Paris, you'll know that this is possibly the most expensive address you can find in the city. It's absolutely beautiful there. It was a less cold day when I was exploring that part of Paris. But on the right there, you can see what the island was, the Île aux Vaches, the Isle of Cows, right up until Jacquet's birth in the mid-17th century. So this is new build, again, you're seeing on the left. But the island, instead of being the most expensive part of Paris, held a network of artisans, of craftsmen, of musicians, of architects, instrument makers. And that's the family, those are the families that Jacquet was born into and married into. Laguerre was part of that as well. There's a vast web of alliances, of intermarriages. And Jacquet was educated by her parents, and boys and girls in the family were educated to survive and thrive in this world and at Versailles. And she reached the top, the very top. She was hugely admired in her own time. She gets into the history books because it's now been proven that she was the first French person to publish sonatas, that very new musical form imported from Italy. There's a rather lovely moment recorded in the records. You'll see this edition is 1707. dedicated yet again to the king, who really is on his last legs by this stage. But Jacques de la Guerre remains loyal. She remained loyal to her original and most powerful patron. And astonishingly, Louis XIV, who disliked new music, and particularly disliked Italian music, seemed to like Jacques de la Guerre's sonatas. He liked them so much that over the summer of 1707, she was summoned to the Petit Couvert of the King to perform. This was to enter the inner sanctum of Versailles. Tall windows provided views to courtyards to the north and south. Impressive canvases depicted military victories. Jacques de la Guerre simply added another sensory pleasure as the king took his lunch. And this is the moment that I love. A brave courtier pointed out to the king that he did not normally appreciate this kind of music. In response, Louis insisted that Jacques de la Guerre's work was like nothing that had come before. Elle est originale. Here is, and I realise I've played two rather sad pieces so far, so here's a little bit more energy from Sonata No. 1 from Jacques de la Guerre. Startlingly modern, by the way, at least in 1707. From Louis XIV to this lady, Empress Maria Theresa, ruler of the Habsburg Empire. And once again, we're in the territory of an exemplary female monarch in search of an exemplary woman to justify her exemplary female rule. She did not have far to look. Maria Theresa's capital is, of course, Vienna, the city of music, the city of Mozart, but also the city of Mariana von Martinez. The Viennese press. How much patriots must rejoice as every day they see ever more how the German nation takes pains to distinguish itself in all the arts with such fine progress. And what rare and special honour it is to the fair sex here to be able to count as a member a woman for whom so many cities have reasons to envy them. Thanks be to the glorious reign of our most honourable Queen, under which all the sister arts have soared so high and will soon lead us to expect a certain level of perfection. This is Maria von Martinez's little bit of Vienna. You have the Michaelerkirche in broad view there, and you've got her house. The family had one of these floors in this house. Haydn, as a young boy, his voice had just broken. He was a chorister, had one of the sort of attic rooms at the same time, young Joseph Haydn. When I say Martinez's little piece of Vienna, it's because she hardly moved more than a few hundred metres from this space. It was a relentless world, or a world of relentless propriety. Some might say claustrophobic. Many music historians would say conservative. Far more stifling, perhaps, than Paris or even Prague, let alone London, where people like Mozart and Haydn escaped as often as they could. Martinez's life was a narrow, circumscribed, albeit extremely comfortable one. But every bar she wrote, every hour she lived, was informed by notions of propriety. However prolific she was, and she was, however nationally and indeed internationally celebrated, as we've just seen, she was, she always walked a narrow path as a composer. She wrote no operas, despite her main teacher influence being the librettist Metastasio, who is honoured with a plaque here, because he lived with the Martinez family. No opera, no symphonies, despite her connections to Haydn, not even a string quartet. That was new music at the time. One has to think or believe, and I certainly do, that Vienna, that city of music, was somewhat of a gilded cage for this composer. And there was no way to leave it. This portrait you see here honours Martinez as the winner of a highly prestigious award, bestowed on her, the first woman to achieve it, and that's why the press were going mad in Vienna, by the Accademia Filarmonica of Bologna, for her composition. But she never made the journey to Italy to accept the award, or more importantly, to supervise the performance or printing of her work. It would not have been proper. You get the sense with Martinez, who perhaps of all the composers I write about is the least known, that something rather special has been lost to us. I want to play just a little extract from a work from 1786, which I think gives a flavour not only of her ability, but of her energy. She's been described as a more athletic Haydn, and I think there's something in that. You can hear the opera that she might have written in another world. Whoops, lost my place. Try that again. She's my go-to composer when I'm feeling a little low. She's absolutely invigorating. We're staying in the German lands, but now we're in Berlin. And I'm going to be talking about, I'm afraid, another gilded cage and more propriety, because I've come to my fifth composer, Born Fanny Mendelssohn, married Wilhelm Hensel, the artist, and became Fanny Hensel. Her home in Berlin, it was a home of great wealth. Here's an old picture of a house that no longer exists, or a mansion, 3 Leipziger Straße, even more privileged than Martinez. And inside this mansion, we have this room, Fanny Hensel's music room. It's absolutely lovely, isn't it? Because, to come back to Virginia Woolf, she had money. She had much more than 500 a year. She had a room of her own. But from the age of 14, she was told to find contentment in this space, in the roles of wife and mother, in domesticity. And bless her, she did, year after year after year. But she was also a composer through and through. Occasionally, I'll come back to this picture, but occasionally, or eventually, she managed to escape. But it makes you wonder what would happen if Martinez had been able to leave Vienna, because Hensel went to Rome. She stayed, spent a lot of time at the Villa Medici there, and it inspired her as a composer, and out of that came what I think is one of her masterpieces, Das Jahr, a piano cycle. It's a long work. It's absolutely marvellous. On the right there, you can see a page from the manuscript illustrated by her husband, Wilhelm, who was an artist. But of course, it's in manuscript. And it stayed in manuscript for home consumption only. And therefore, it's not part of our repertoire now. Now, Hensel's story is a complex one, and I don't have time to go into it now. But suffice to say that even after 2 trips to Italy, she returned, and much composition, she returned to Berlin and died far too young. I personally am very touched that someone, and I think it's Wilhelm, don't know whether you can see here, put on her tombstone, which is in the Lutheran cemetery, which is another strand to the Mendelssohn story, the conversion to Christianity. But here on Fanny Hensel's tombstone is a little piece of music, the notes from the manuscript that she was working on at the time of her death. At least by her husband, I think it was him, she was recognised as the composer she was. She wrote over 400 works, most of which we're still only just discovering. Now, I want to pause for a moment and think about where we've got to. Because the forgetting of Fanny Hensel, it's always more complicated than simply gender. There's lots of other factors, believe me. But the forgetting of Fanny Hensel, who did publish just a small handful of works during her lifetime, and then there are a couple of posthumous publications, is connected with her being a woman. And the critics were absolutely sure that they could hear that she was a woman by looking at her music. They lack a commanding individual idea. They have an outward aspect, but they don't have an inner aspect. They have gracious, pleasant elements, but they lack powerful feeling drawn from deep conviction. And these kinds of comments mark a devastating, subtle, but devastating shift in the way in which the work of women composers was understood between the era of Martinez and that of Hensel. The compositions of Martinez and her predecessors were certainly understood in terms of the composer's sex, but it was deemed remarkable, exceptional, sometimes even admirable and useful to the powers that be for a woman to produce such fine music. A woman composer would have to take care that she was properly feminine according to the values of her society, but the music she composed was not in itself deemed feminine. I could talk much more about the impact of that conceptual shift upon the composers who followed on from Fanny Hensel. But I will just confine myself to saying, at first sight, previous eras' insistence on silence or the equation of a composition with prostitution seem long gone by the time we get to Fanny Hensel. replaced by a more benign vision of the female musician, female composer, if she's allowed, as a domestic goddess, her creativity confined to the home, an accompaniment, literally and metaphorically, to family life. The idea would prove to be a poisoned chalice, just as women composers began to escape what I've called the shadow of the courtesan, the sexualization of their art. The new challenge would be to gain access to the great, new, and crucially public arenas for classical music, the opera houses, the concert halls of Europe and North America. For Hensel's successors, even now, this remains the final frontier. I don't have time today to talk about Clara Schumann here as Clara Wieck before her marriage to Robert, but suffice to say that she internalised pretty much all those beliefs about what women could do, couldn't do, the kind of music that women wrote, and she silenced herself, not before having 8 children, 6 of whom are shown here. No time for them today. I might have to speed, I'm afraid, you through Paris, my next creative community. This is the Paris of the turn of the 19th, 20th century. It's the 9th arrondissement, a world in which the Boulanger family lived downstairs from the professor of composition at the Conservatoire, where Fauré drops in for tea, where Vidor looks over your manuscript score. It is no surprise that this world created a female composer. But it is surprising that it is Lily Boulanger, not Nadia, who was that composer. It was Lily, the younger sister, who saw Nadia fail to reach the very top of the musical pile in Paris at this time, despite everyone agreeing that Nadia had more talent than all the other competitors in the various competitions that were going on. It was Lily who won the prize, the Prix de Rome, which eluded her sister, at least in part. Part of Lily's strategy was to present herself as a femme fragile. Nadia Boulanger could never be described as a femme fragile. Now, it wasn't exactly a persona. Lily was extremely ill for much of her life, and within the family, she signed her letters Bébé. She was the little sister, after all. But it certainly wasn't the whole truth, the femme fragile. Boulanger, Lily Boulanger, was assiduous, professional, at times ruthless and manipulative. And she succeeded in Paris in ways her sister could only dream of. There are the two sisters on the left. There's Nadia, there's Lily, who's actually taller than her sister, little Lily. And there is Lily with the three other the finalists of the Prix de Rome, the competition, as I say, that Lily was the first woman to win. And here, I know it's not a great picture, but here's Lily with her extremely large dog, which complicates, I think, in interesting ways, this presentation of herself as the femme fragile. Now, Lily's winning of the Prix de Rome in 1913 gave her, on paper, 2 years at the Villa Medici in Rome, which we saw a bit earlier. Now, that's another musical community. It should be a creative community. But it didn't quite work for Lily, and I'm sorry I don't have time to talk about that now, but it's something to do with systems that are set up to work, as it were, for patriarchy, to work for men, and you put in a token woman into that system, and funnily enough, the woman fails. It's about systemic sexism. The other thing that makes Lily particularly interesting is that if the Villa Medici and the Prix de Rome didn't particularly help her become the composer she was, become recognised, World War I did, because again and again you find nationalism trumping gender. The fact that she was French for a brief time meant more than that she was only a woman. I'm going to press on, but as you can see, I have a little icon down there, and I could play some music from Boulanger if you'd like towards at the end. But I do want to move on to my final composer, and some closing comments. The final composer I chose to write about is Elizabeth McConkie, and I want to highlight two very different communities. But both of these communities enabled her to be one of the great composers of the 20th century. On the left, you've got the Royal College of Music in London, where McConkie came as a very shy, ill-educated 16-year-old girl from her home in Dublin. And there she had a marvellous teacher in Ray Vaughan Williams, the epitome of a good teacher. Their musical styles were completely different, but Vaughan Williams appreciated what McConkie had, appreciated her distinctive style. He wrote, she must work out her own salvation, and he let her do that by helping her every step of the way. She made lifelong musical friends, such as the composer, the Welsh composer, Grace Williams. But even at the Royal College of Music, if we're thinking about systemic sexism, institutional sexism, McConkie won the Mendelssohn Prize. She was told that she'd won it, and then she found out the next day that she hadn't. And the decision had been made by the committee that if we gave it to a woman, quote, you'd only go off and get married and not compose another note. What do you do in the face of that? Well, one answer is you go to Prague, as McConkie did, and she was a sensation there. And again, I'm very happy to play you, if there's time in a moment, the work that was made her name there, Concerto for Piano. Reached another dead end, so she thought, right, I'll send off my music to Henry Wood at the Proms. And her work was performed, a piece called The Land. In the Proms of 1930s, headline screamed, Girl Composer Triumphs. Another dead end, because she couldn't get her music published. Major publishers like Boosey and Hawkes were saying, well, we can't publish these big, driving, Bartokian works from a woman. We want some little pieces. We want some nice, pretty little songs. Can't you do those? And what happened then happened in this building here, which I visited just a few weeks ago. I didn't go inside. It's a private house now. But it's the Ballet Club Theatre near Notting Hill off the Portobello Road. The beginnings of the Ballet Rambert are there. And I do want to just share with you a moment from the beginning of this wonderful venture. Faced with the intransigence of the music industry, a remarkable group of women got together in 1931 and changed the face of music in London, at least for a few years. One was Iris Lamar, that rare thing, a female conductor. The other two were the violinist Anne McNaughton and the composer Elizabeth Lutyens. Together, they launched a series of concerts to showcase new music by young composers alongside works from eras underrepresented in the concert halls of London at the time. They are one of the reasons we know Purcell. The McNaughton-Lamar concerts were to prove an absolute lifeline for Elizabeth McConkie through the 1930s. As I said, this is their venue. It was small, it was cheap. It was once a ragged school. Their methods were collaborative and informal. There was no committee, no hierarchy, just the drive to create a platform for their own work, whether as performer, conductor, or composer. Honestly, remembered one of the organisers, it wasn't altruistic, it suited each other's ends. Anne McNaughton, however, who shouldered much of the organisational responsibility, was eloquent about the driving vision. And I feel her words are relevant to the world of music, past, present, and future. She said, the great thing is to have lots of music going on all the time, lots of things being performed, because committees always set themselves up as judges, arbitrators as to what is good and what is bad. But the thing is to play music and it will settle itself sooner or later. As long as there's plenty of opportunity to get new works performed, no harm will be done. What is awful is if somebody is really doing something very good, but nobody knows about it. Now, as the Musical Times reported in these the early years of the 1930s, there is nothing quite like these concerts in London. The concert givers get to grips with the real thing in a most delightful, unconventional way. And after an evening spent with them, one feels that music is gloriously alive. What is awful is if somebody is really doing something very good, but nobody knows about it. And what is just as awful, and I hope perhaps some of my words today may have convinced you of this, is if somebody did something very good, and because they were in the right place at the right time, They were allowed, despite the accident of their sex, despite the beliefs about women in their time, they were not stopped entirely in their tracks. Whether it took a Tuscan princess or a Habsburg empress, whether French nationalism or the Venetian printing presses, in their lifetime, people knew about it. Elle est originale. But then that time and place pass and the forgetting begins. And that's why I want to end with Fanny Hensel, denied to us so long. Her music, thanks to this recording by the Eben Quartet, is now nearly 200 years after its composition, gloriously alive. It is being heard. In my enthusiasm for Hensel's music, I should have cut that one down, I think, but it is so joyous. That's the final movement of her one surviving string quartet. With Hensel's music, I wanted to end, but now I'd like to hear your questions about these wonderful composers. Thank you.